Accession number 28361, Reel 48.
Julian Thompson, Reel 48. You were saying that it takes quite a long time to get the landing craft loaded because of the way in which it has to be done.
Yes. They climb down the ramp, which is like a sort of false beach in the dock, and the water's lapping in and swishing in and out, and the landing craft are sitting there, and the chaps climb in up onto one landing craft, along the catwalk, down into the next. So it takes quite a long time to happen.
They're quite heavily loaded too.
And they're heavily loaded, and they've had to come down through red lit passageways, down through narrow little hatchways, down stairwells, and so forth. And it takes a long time. And remember, they had never been in that ship before. They were originally going to land from Canberra. Luckily, they were Marines, and so they were reasonably familiar with ships. And secondly, they had something in the order of 24 plus 48 hours to familiarise themselves with the what was known as the assault routes. How do you get from your mess deck, which is say three decks down below the waterline, in some compartment at the other end of the ship, carrying all your kit up three ladders, along a passageway, stepping over things called dwarf bulkheads, which are the things into which the doors go, which are like sills, and you step over that. They're great traps, actually, for tripping over. So you can imagine this cursing, sweating, though it's cold outside, it's warm inside the ship. Bunch of darkened Marines, all effing and blinding, as they shuffle along. And it takes hours, actually. And so you had to start this process a long time before you wanted to finish it.
Were they deployed in mess decks in such a way as to facilitate their arrival in the right sequence?
Well,
or
yes.
Or had this not been possible?
Yes, I mean, it was possible to a degree. But the ship was something like 700 men as overload. So the whole wardroom was stripped of furniture, and you had a company living in the wardroom on the floor.
Yeah.
You had men sleeping on the floor of the tank deck. You had men sleeping in the landing craft on the deck, which was why I didn't want to transfer them. I think I may have alluded to it earlier, in South Georgia, some 4 or 5 days before D-Day, which was one of the suggestions, and have men arrive who had no sleep for four nights, effectively, before actually going to battle. So that's why I'd resisted doing it.
Do you think they had been able to get a reasonable amount of sleep, most of them?
I think they'd managed to sleep. I mean, Marines can sleep just about anywhere, but you know, I wanted them to be as rested as they possibly could be.
What sort of atmosphere was there? What was the mood that you sensed as you were hugely watching them loading?
Hugely tense atmosphere, and one of great sort of, and one. I remember asking a number of them how they felt, and most of them said okay. One of them said to me, "I feel a bit frightened." So I said, well, don't worry about that. Everybody does, and it's perfectly normal to feel like that. Don't feel that you're different to everybody else, because everyone's feeling frightened, but you'll be okay once this thing starts going. And he said, you know, thank you very much, sir, or something. I think he nobody knew who I was or not. I didn't know, because it was dark. You know, it was just a dim light. But there was this feeling of intense, you know, this is about something we're going to, and it had been a huge work up to it. 7 weeks they'd been waiting to do this, and you know, was it on, was it off, was diplomatic means going to be found to get round this, or whatever, and here at last, here we were.
What do you think is the main source of that sort of tension? Is it the uncertainty, or is it the possibility of lethal risk?
Well, it's A, uncertainty, and B, what's going to happen to me? What's it going to be like? You've got to remember, most of these guys have never been in a proper war.
Well, had any of them?
Well, a few had been, I mean, the more senior chaps had been company commanders in the Dhofar, which was quite a hot little war, but none of the others, other than Northern Ireland, had been in something where they were going to get, you know, shelled and bombed by aeroplanes and face artillery fire and that sort of thing. None of them had got any of that.
Those who've been in Dofile, as you were saying, I mean, these would be officers.
Yeah, they'd be officers. People. I mean,
the Marines themselves presumably would be younger.
The younger Marines never been in anything like this, no.
But they might have been shot at in Ireland or had the risk of being shot
at. Yeah, they might have been, but they weren't facing the unknown, and the unknown factors were what was the Argentine Air Force going to do? They already knew it was fairly potent. It had sunk the Sheffield and attacked other ships, which they'd heard about. They'd never faced artillery fire. Was there any artillery there? And they had never carried out an amphibious assault where there might be enemy. And though we were pretty sure there wasn't anything there, you never knew, of course. The enemy might have moved something in that night. So there were a lot of... There was a huge amount of uncertainty. And, of course, what mattered was the fact they were all surrounded by their mates and chums and so forth, and so that was the binding and thing for them.
The uncertainty and the tension over the uncertainty, doing something effectively new, that's understandable. Were they also confident, do you think? Did they think they could actually do it, even though it might be dangerous and all?
Yes, I mean, I got the impression they were totally confident in their ability, in their training, and belief in themselves. And certainly I'd got this feeling not only that night, but going around visiting and talking to people, which I'd been doing for the previous 7 weeks. There was a total confidence in, and a total, I mean, almost a sort of, you know, arrogance that we're going to hack this problem. But even then, even though you're totally confident in all the people around you, there is, of course, the personal thing. You know, am I going to survive? Am I going to have a horrible wound? Am I going to do all right? Or am I going to let my chums down? There's always, those are the things that go through your mind.
Well, there is a difference, isn't there, between the corporate psychology, that we can do this because we're trained for it.
Yeah.
And the individual psychology,
absolutely.
You know, I might get rubbed out in the process.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or something else even more horrible might happen.
Yeah, sure, or, again, that you'll let your mates down.
Mm. But do you think that was the worst prospect?
I think that's probably uppermost in people's minds. Am I going to make a cock of it? Am I going to run away? Am I going to fail to do my duty? Am I going to not fire my GPMG and sort of hide behind a hole shivering in fear and let everybody down? I think that's uppermost, actually. It's what keeps people going.
So this is a prolonged process. They were getting into the landing. When they were in the landing craft, were they standing or were they sitting or squatting? How were they actually?
Well, those that found room to sit would sit, but most people would be standing because there's quite a lot of there's a certain amount of water swishing around in the bottom of the landing craft.
Yeah.
So which are not designed as troop carriers, incidentally. They're designed as vehicle carriers. Mm. Of course, some of them were in. I forgot to mention this, and I should mention this. Some of them were in the troop carrying landing craft, the LCVPs, which were carried on the side of the ship in davits, and getting into those was much easier because they're designed to have troops get into them, whereas the landing craft in the dock are designed for vehicles, and there was no great thought that you'd have to bring troops from mess decks down into the dock. So all the assault routes for troops are up onto the davits. All you do is just step across onto the landing craft, which is alongside the ship on the davits, and when it's full, it's just lowered with all the troops in it. That's slightly better than getting into an LCV into an LCU. So each battalion or commando in each wave had four LCUs and four LCVPs.
How many would you get in an LCVP?
35 that's men.
So it's a platoon.
Yeah, it's designed to be a platoon load.
So this is like the old landing craft assault, isn't it?
Well, it's the Mark II LCA, the LCVP. I mean, it's the direct successor to the old LCA.
How does it differ from the old LCA?
Well, it differs from the LCA in that it's got a better engine. The LCA, and I've driven one, had two Chevrolet petrol engines back aft in a little sort of engine room. And the coxswain of the LCA was in an armoured cabinet in the at the bow, and actually gave orders on using engine telegraphs to a chap, and this is all historical stuff, an ERA sitting in his little between the two engines at the back end. The LCVP the coxswain was in a little bridge at the back end in the stern, and it was much faster than the LCA. It had a longer ramp, which gave you a better landing facility. Mm. But other than that, it was exactly the same. And it had diesel engines instead of petrol engines, which are safer.
Did they have the same sort of handling characteristics?
More or less, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. So you've got your guys into the craft, and
this
is a time-consuming process.
Yes, but you start it long before
you arrive.
Before you start getting people in while she's still steaming in, when the deck dock gates up, and people are doing it, so it's concurrent activity. Mm. Mm. And the chaps are getting into the LCVPs while you're still steaming along. Mm. So. That's the advantage of having a dock, and you can be doing a lot of this while the dock gates are still closed and there's no water in the dock.
Mm. What happened then? Did they get away in time, according to Shane?
They then got away more or less on time. There was then a delay, because you've got the first wave, which consists of 40 Commando and 2 Para, is forming up. Now, 2 Para had a big problem, because they had to get from the Norland, which was cross-channel ferry, into LCUs and LCVPs alongside. And so they had to come out of a door in the side of the Norland, which was, I think, some door for loading kitchen supplies. I don't know what the door was for, but she had a door on the side. I mean, it wasn't specially cut.
I think they just started going through the galley.
I think it was the door that they load, the supplies for the galley through when you're alongside a dock. And the landing craft had to come alongside, and the chaps had to then get on to the landing craft,
Did
step
they have
out.
Scrambling nets or anything of that sort?
No, the landing craft was more or less at the same sort of level as it happened. I mean, it might have been slightly below, but it wasn't all that below. The captain of Norland didn't help by not putting out a rope for the landing craft to hook onto. Which he'd been told to do, but remember, he'd only ever had one rehearsal in Ascension, and I think he had other things on his mind. I mean, you're dealing with merchant navy crews who'd never done this before. Mm. Never. We hadn't had all these rehearsals that we had before D-Day in Normandy, where we did it time and time and time again to get it right. These guys had one rehearsal in daylight at Ascension Island. So the landing craft had to keep its engines going to keep it in one place, and it took a very long time.
Yeah.
And this wasn't helped by the fact that one parachute soldier fell between the two, and they did that and crushed his pelvis, so he had to be fished out.
Mm.
Taken back on board. And in fact, they were something like an hour late.
So they were presumably getting into the boats one by one, soldier by soldier.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it would be very difficult to keep the craft adjacent.
Without
a rope to hang on to.
Exactly. Yeah. So
it's unrigged transfer, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it was a very very difficult transfer, and all credit to everybody that it worked. It just took longer than planned, and this meant that HR was going to be late.
Yeah.
And at that stage, I had my deputy brigade commander riding in with the first wave with a radio.
Well, who was that?
A chap called Tom Seccombe, Colonel Seccombe, S-E-C-C-O-M-B-E. Now, I didn't have a deputy brigade commander. There was no such person on establishment.
No post.
There was no post. Mm. And the genesis of that, which is tracking back a long way, is that I had three battalions or commandos in the Canberra. I had 40 Commando, 42 Commando, and 3 Para in the Canberra. And I was concerned there should be some overall OC troops, as it were, there, who would be in charge of sorting out arguments between the COs as to what training areas in the ship belong to whom, and all the mundane things about which everyone gets so heated if you're not careful. There was also the Navy were putting a four-ring captain on board. And I, knowing the Navy as I do, God bless them, I knew this chap would start trying to take charge of the COs because he was senior to them. So I decided I'd put someone of the same rank on board who would represent me. And so Tom Seccombe happened to be unemployed at the time. he was a great mate of mine. We trained together. I've known him for all my service life. And so I asked for him to go on board the Canberra and be the... And then, of course, he naturally, as a full colonel, fell into the post of being deputy brigade commander. And he went in with the leading wave. And we had a message, because we were running late. Was there going to be a sort of formal delay of HR? Were we going to say, you know, HR now delay? And I said, no, just let it be late. Because just imagine, you've got 8 LCUs and 8 LCVPs. So that's 16 landing crafts sculling around like this. How do you get the message to 16 different landing craft, which will arrive garbled anyway? You don't want to break radio silence. So the answer is shut up, let's get on with it. If we're late, we're late. Just let it roll.
So you keep the HR as a formal HR, but the real HR adjusts itself
so that when Ewan South Petalia, who's actually in charge of all the landing craft, Major South Petalia, someone I think you should talk to as well, decides that everything's ready to go, he, using an Aldis lamp, flashes, okay, start running in.
Right.
And so the craft sweep round the corner, and HMS Plymouth was sort of riding shotgun on all this lot. She was a frigate, ready to give immediate naval gunfire support straight down the throats of anyone who tried to interfere with anybody on the way.
Direct point blank fire.
Point blank fire. Yeah. I mean, there were NGFOs with the COs of each commander or battalion who could have talked to Plymouth and said, there's a problem here. But she was actually sort of shepherding them in.
How were the landing craft actually laid out and formed for the run-in? And were they in line abreast or...
I can't remember. I think you'd have to speak to you and Sir Peter. I'll just go and get his book and see if there's something in there. If you bear with me a second. What he says in his book about two paras... transfer is two para not being able to practice as tricky and alien even to the Royal Marines method of going to war by loading one by one through narrow doors 10 feet or so above the waterline of into small craft lying not steadily alongside. The landing area for any man jumping or climbing down a rope ladder was 2 feet wide. If he missed it by jumping too far out, he'd fall an extra 6 feet into the tank deck, and if he fell short, he'd be crushed in the water between 5,000 tons and 100 tons. The operation was carried out in the dark with a slight swell running, and with little the LCU coxswains could do to keep the craft stationary fore and aft, and certainly not up or down laterally. To add to the difficulty, there were no mooring strong points or any line to the deck. None of this was ideal. In fact, it was downright farcical.
But the net effect is you had one casualty and a 1 hour delay.
Yeah, which is not bad, actually.
Relatively minor disruption, considering. I was going to ask you about the sea conditions and what effect they were having on the
whole business. It was just a slight swell, a very, very slight swell.
That was good luck.
That was good luck.
Really? I mean, obviously.
Mind you, Falkland Sound is pretty, you know, it's fairly sheltered.
Yes.
Unless you've got a real hooli blowing, in which case we'd have had to have gone inside and done it.
Yeah. Well, presumably, if the weather had been rougher...
In fact, what he did was he left one landing craft, which was delayed, he left it behind. I mean, it caught up in the end.
I see, yes.
You know, because he couldn't wait any longer.
Mm.
The five-mile passage it was for the landing craft.
Yeah. And the way they form up, as far as I remember it, is to circle round.
They circle round.
Until
then
eventually they're laid out as the...
Well, they circle round, and then what happens is he then... where are we? I think they just form up and go.
Yeah. So there's a point in the circling where they're all in.
They all line up and off they go.
Yeah.
They'll line up and go.
Okay.
So that's that. Okay.
So what were you doing? You were down in the Fearless.
At this stage, I went up into the Amphibious Operations Room. Once they'd gone, there was no point in being in the dock anymore. I went into the AOR, which was where I learnt that things were going late and so forth. And there was really nothing I could do. So occasionally I'd wander up onto the bridge and see if I could see anything. And then the reports started coming in to say we're ashore. That was it. And that there was nothing, and there was no opposition, and so on. And so there was nothing else again to do, because chaps were going off to their defensive positions, and Tupara had to walk up onto Sussex Mountain and so on. But there was nothing for me to do, and there was no chatter on the net other than, you know, we're here.
How were the reports of landing delivered?
On the brigade command net.
By wireless, on the brigade.
Yeah, by radio.
Just one net.
Yeah, on the brigade command net.
Yeah, so there must have been quite a lot of stations on there.
Oh, yes, there were a lot of stations. But at that stage, the only stations I was interested in, and the only people who were talking, were the two commanders, the 40 commando and two para, who were just coming back, and I can't remember what their call signs were, but they would have been using daily changing call signs, which are something like Whiskey 2, Golf 0, Bravo, or something like that, with a nickname, which I can't remember, saying, which meant we're here.
So they're using code words?
They were using nicknames, yeah.
Pre-arranged code words.
Pre-arranged nicknames.
Yeah.
And of course it's not a secure net, remember?
No.
Because it's a man-packed net. Mm. Only when they get their BVs ashore can they start using secure radios.
Mm. Did anything go back to them, or were you just receiving at that stage?
Receiving. I mean, I could have chatted to them, but I didn't.
Mm. So no real need.
There's no need, like to say.
The plan. This is rather, in a way, like an 18th century battle, isn't it? That the plan is made on the eve of battle.
Yeah.
Everyone has their kit, and in the morning,
yeah,
the army starts moving, and there isn't really a great deal the commander can do.
No.
He has just watch it unfold like a mechanical toy.
Sure, it's not just an 18th century battle. Every sort of battle, really, actually, until it all starts going wrong.
Yeah.
Really. Okay.
So up to that point, things have been going right.
Things are going
late,
but right.
Yes. Yeah.
They then the landing craft now have to come back.
Yeah.
And pick up three para from Intrepid, so they come into the dock and pick them up, and they also have to go alongside Canberra to pick up one of the companies of 4-5 Commando. And alongside the Stromness, which is an RFA, in which the rest of 4-5 Commando are in. And that, again, is a time-consuming business. They've got to clamber down rope, you know, cargo, you know, down scrambling nets into the landing craft. And again, it takes time.
Did that put them behind schedule?
And it they're already late, but it takes longer than one wanted, because now you've got three para in a strange ship, and they haven't had time, they haven't preloaded into the landing craft like 40 Commando had. They have to wait till the landing craft come into the dock and then get in. Now they're doing something they've never done before. So again, it takes time, and the captain and crew of Intrepid were not too clever in that they hadn't actually given them the opportunity to practice it in the 48 hours in which they were on board.
So they didn't know their way down the corridor.
Well, they were taken by guides, but, you know, again, it was even more confusing. And it was against the clock. So now everything's getting later and later and later.
Cumulative time penalty.
Cumulative time. And instead of their landing in darkness, as they'd been told, it was broad daylight. And here we were, sitting outside
San Carlos,
and the daylight's coming, and the next threat is going to be the Argentine air. Mm. Anyway, there was nothing you could do about it. You just had to let it roll. Mm. And so when they arrive, it's daylight. And 4-5 Commando arrive, and there's no problem. They go to Ajax Bay and up onto the high ground, which is their task. The three power have a more difficult time, because it was impossible to do any beach gradient recces at Port San Carlos because of the Argentine company that was sitting there in the village. So you didn't want SBS chaps all splashing around trying to take soundings there, because that would have given away the game. So though Ewan knew pretty much about the beach, the one thing he wasn't quite sure about was the beach gradient like for the final run-in onto Green Beach, which was the three-para beach. and the LCU is grounded quite a long way off shore.
Is this on a reef or on
this
a
was on a runnel,
slope.
I think.
Yes.
And so, do you want to let this go, or do you want it to be? You don't want to hear this.
Yes.
You're quite happy with this. Mm-hmm. So, what do they do? Mm. What they actually did was they landed the LCVPs that could get in, and they transferred troops from the LCUs into the LCUs. Well, that was also took time.
Yes, that must have been quite a complicated business.
It was. Mm. And, of course, fortunately, the half-company of Argentines in the village decided they weren't going to fight it out with three para and decided to push off, because they could have given them quite a hard time, actually. Mm. While they were, you know, buggering about getting from one craft to the other and all that sort of thing.
How far offshore were they when they were
about, about 100 yards off.
So if they'd been in positions on covering the
beach, they would have cut them to pieces.
Yes.
But they decided not to and pushed off.
Had they decided not to before they were aware that landing craft were approaching
or afterwards?
I don't know.
I think when they saw them coming, I think when they saw loads and loads of landing craft and loads of ships in coming round the corner, they decided that, you know, half a company wasn't going to stop this lot, so they might as well save their lives and push off. Mm. They actually did some damage later, which I can talk about later. Anyway, it's now daylight.
Yeah.
The second wave has landed, and then, as planned, all the amphibious ships and merchant ships up anchor and steam round the corner into San Carlos water, as arranged. So here it is on a chart.
So they're now in the narrow.
So they now come through place. and they anchor inside here.
Yeah. What's the idea of doing that?
Well, the idea of doing that is that in there you're far safer from submarines with all these merchant ships.
Yes.
You're more difficult to attack. I mean, they're not impossible to attack. You certainly can't be attacked by Exocet in there.
Is that because of the terrain around?
Yeah, the terrain, because you've got high ground all around you. It's like a sea lock, effectively.
So you've got clutter, then, too.
You've got clutter. I mean, no Exocet can get at you there.
Mm. What about attack with iron bombs, though?
Just iron bombs. You can be attacked with iron bombs. Yes, but, again, it's more difficult than it is out here, because an aircraft approaching you, flying low, doesn't know where you are until it's there.
So he only has a very short period of time in which to select a target.
He has a short period to select a target, correct, yeah.
Presumably also, if you have got anti-aircraft assets, you can concentrate their fire in a sort of umbrella over the water.
Yes, yeah. And you are well protected in here from quite a lot of things, but not everything. And what stayed out originally were all the ships providing naval gunfire support, like Ardent down the bottom there.
Yes.
Yarmouth, Brilliant, I'm reading these out, Antrim, and other ships, Broadsword, Fort Austin actually came in eventually, of course. And these were the ships that were providing support for us. There's Plymouth inside. This is the first day.
Yes. Well, obviously, you need to deploy them where they can actually shoot, and they couldn't shoot if they're all crammed into.
Well, there are no
targets, presumably.
Well, no, I mean, the only ships that are needing to shoot back are Plymouth, which is a naval gunfire support ship, and the ships here are either merchant ships with no guns on them, or landing ships which have got one Bofors on them or a couple of Ehrlichans, so they're not in the business of shooting at anything other than aeroplanes.
The day came up. What could you actually see as the dawn came up?
Well, I could see this wonderful view of what looked the sunlight, of what looks just like a Scottish sea loch. Looked exactly like that. And I could see sort of landing craft. I was in Fearless, so she came round the corner and anchored, and I could see this wonderful scene. And very soon, we got a shout air raid warning red, and the first of the air raids started coming in about an hour after first light, and they went on all day.
What was the drill for receiving air raids?
Well, the drill was that the two things really. There were the people who could do something about it, which was the people who were in the ships. They went to action stations. So they manned Oerlikons or CCAP missiles or whatever they had to shoot back with, or GPMGs. Everybody else got off the deck and stayed in their accommodation. What? Or, you know, as far as I was concerned.